coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. When state lawmakers return to work next week, the effort to legalize recreational marijuana is expected to resume. But that effort faces some headwinds at Lake Hall.
When people hear it's legal, they see that as a carte blanche. It's legal under all circumstances, including getting behind the wheel of a car.
Our Roman Battalion looks at who's opposing marijuana legalization. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also examine lawmakers' efforts to tackle PFAS chemicals in Delawareans' drinking water and hear from another candidate seeking a seat on Dover City Council this month. Plus, Arts Playlist looks at the latest exhibitions at the Biggs Museum in Dover. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The battle over legalizing recreational marijuana is expected to heat up when state lawmakers return to work next week. While polls show a majority of Delawareans support legalization, opposition remains. And some organizations have concerns legal weed could only bring more crime and danger to the state. Delaware Public Media's Report for America Corps member Roman Battaglia talks to those putting up roadblocks to approving recreational cannabis in Delaware.
With each subsequent year, the effort to legalize recreational marijuana in Delaware gains more traction. But it's yet to be enough to overcome an uphill climb to approval. Because it involves a tax, the bill requires a two-thirds majority to pass both houses, leaving almost no wiggle room for Democratic lawmakers trying to get it to Governor John Carney's desk. And so far, the bill has failed to reach that threshold, with some Democrats withholding support. The latest version of a recreational cannabis bill currently waits in the House Appropriations Committee, where it faces scrutiny over funding the program, as well as what to do with potential tax revenue that comes with the sale of legal weed. Supporters of legalization have worked to address issues raised by that scrutiny from critics. Back in 2017, a task force looked at those issues and made recommendations for a path to legalize marijuana in the state. But opponents almost kept that report from seeing the light of day. Its release passed by just one vote. One notable group objecting then and now is the state's law enforcement community. It takes aim at one of the chief goals of the bill, eliminating the marijuana black market. The prime sponsor of this year's bill, State Representative Ed Ozinski, says it would do that, taking control out of the hands of gangs and criminals while generating tax revenue that can be used to fund public education and substance abuse programs. Jeffrey Horvath, executive director of the Delaware Police Chiefs Council, disputes that, saying it hasn't rung true in other states.
And in Colorado, they talked about that. That's the big promise that the legal recreational marijuana industry makes. It'll get rid of the black market. In Colorado, they told us the exact opposite. They said it made the black market stronger, and it created a new market called the gray market. So now you've got people that are legally growing marijuana. They're growing more than they can sell, and it is disappearing out the back door and being sold in a gray market. So it's legally grown and illegally sold.
When marijuana is legalized in a state, officials often see a massive boom in the production of the plant, so much that consumption can't keep up. And because the drug is still illegal at the federal level, all marijuana produced in the state legally must be consumed there. So Horvath says extra buds make their way to the criminal market, where they can be trafficked out of state. Oregon was one of the first states to legalize recreational marijuana, doing so by statewide referendum back in 2014. And since then, Jason Myers with the Oregon Sheriff's Association says that state has grappled with a marijuana surplus.
The amount that's grown in Oregon is like tenfold of what could be consumed in Oregon. So it's going somewhere. It's leaking outside of the system. And that's our concern because oftentimes there is big revenue in it. And along with that comes criminal activity. And I think that's a big issue that our sheriffs in Southern Oregon are facing right now.
This Oregon surplus has left over a six-year supply of weed sitting in warehouses and processing plants. On top of that, marijuana inspectors in that state are stretched thin. Without proper coverage of inspectors to visit dispensaries and farms, it can be easier for those growers to slip surplus weed into the black market instead of leaving it to expire in a warehouse. Meyer says Oregon can be an example of what can be learned when legalizing recreational marijuana in other states.
The legislature in Oregon has had to act on this every session to create, you know, kind of a new round of regulations and control. And there's something that can be learned from that because we're kind of learning as we go. So you're kind of building the ship as you're shipping out in the ocean. I think in your situation, you have the opportunity to be able to learn from others. And if that's the direction that the legislature decides to go, that they can put the proper protocols and parameters in place to make sure that it's done, you know, in a manner that's safe and fair and good for the community.
Some of those lessons have already been taken into consideration in Delaware. To combat a huge influx of marijuana into the state, there are strict license caps at each stage of production, which attempt to limit the number of cannabis producers and prevent what happened in Oregon. But some marijuana advocates argue the cap isn't high enough, and a surplus is actually good for consumers. In Oregon, prices dropped significantly with the production boom, making the drug more affordable for both recreational and medical users. Ozinski says the Delaware proposed license cap strikes a balance between maintaining the right amount of supply and limiting a surplus. Plus, the bill gives the state marijuana director the ability to hand out more licenses based on supply and demand. Horvath says visiting Colorado taught him other lessons about possible pitfalls of legalization. One is handling edibles. Edibles were only recently allowed in Delaware's medical marijuana market, and no compassion center has yet to produce any. But the new recreational cannabis bill would fully allow edible products into the market, including gummies, drinks, and more. Horvath says in talking with sheriffs in Colorado, edibles cause the most problems there.
You know, these edibles are designed like gummy bears and cookies and brownies, things that are attractive to children. And we've had issues with children having to spend, you know, several days in the hospital because they take such strong doses of THC and these edibles. Issues with people that, you know, you get a cookie and it tells you to eat 1/8 of the cookie. And after an hour, they don't feel much. So they eat more of the cookie. And before you know it, they're having an issue where they think they're medically having a problem, and the ambulance was called.
In fact, Delaware's 2017 task force recommended changes to the way edibles are produced and sold to make them less appealing to children, and those recommendations made it into this year's bill. Under HB 150, edibles can't be produced to look like candy or resemble cartoon characters, and can't contain additives designed to make the product appealing to children. The containers also have to be designed like pill bottles, difficult to open for anyone under 5. Horvath adds it's not just the appeal edibles have to children, it's the example parents set by consuming them.
Kids see their parents doing that and they're thinking, oh, you know, I'll be 18 in a few years or 21 in a few years, whatever the legal limit age is going to be, I can sneak it now. I'm more likely to do it.
But the jury is still out on whether legalizing cannabis increases usage among teens. One study in Canada, which legalized recreational use nationwide in 2018, showed youth cannabis use remained fairly stable both before and after recreational use was legalized. Around 1/3 of teens in Canada have used the drug. Here in the States, a study in California found legalizing recreational sales of marijuana had an insignificant impact on usage by young adults. But the study also reported legalization may have prompted slightly increased interest in the drug among women and e-cigarette users. But most studies say it's still too early to draw any definitive conclusions on the impact of marijuana legalization. Less than 10 years of data isn't enough to identify clear trends. The law enforcement community is often backed up by another group in the fight against legalizing cannabis, traffic safety advocates. AAA has long been against legalizing the drug, citing the wide-reaching effects it has on all aspects of driving. Ken Grant is the manager of public and government affairs at AAA Mid-Atlantic. He says the culture of driving while under the influence of marijuana is something that needs to be addressed before considering legalization of the drug.
Are people currently driving while under the influence of marijuana? Yes, they are. But once you put that label of legal in front of it for every adult in the state, you have several people who say, oh, then I can go ahead and consume whatever I wish, whether it's through edibles, through smoking, through waxing, whatever. And, you know, go out, get behind the wheel of the car and start driving. And that's just dangerous.
Grant compares marijuana use and driving to the decades-long effort to get people to stop drinking and driving.
That shift about drunk driving, that has taken decades to get people to understand just how dangerous it is. I mean, it wasn't too long ago when you could turn on the TV set or watch a movie and see a person at the bar, you know, proudly proclaim, hey, I'll have one for the road. That obviously is no longer socially acceptable. It's a problem that still persists, even in the midst of all this education. Fortunately, we have seen a steady decline, finally, over the past 10 years, of drunk driving fatalities. However, at the same time, we're seeing an increase in drugged driving fatalities.
And the amount of people getting high and driving is increasing. According to the CDC, that number has been increasing every year, while the number of people drinking and driving continues to decline. Grant says more investment in education is needed to shift the culture on marijuana use in America. Many people don't know marijuana significantly increases the chance of an accident while out on the road. There's also the problem of enforcement. If you've ever seen someone get pulled over for drunk driving, you may recognize a small device called a breathalyzer. That tool allows law enforcement to quickly measure someone's blood alcohol level, which tells them exactly how drunk someone is. But right now, a marijuana breathalyzer doesn't yet exist outside of field tests.
Yeah, the standard line I hear is, well, we'll just treat driving under the influence of marijuana the same way as we treat driving under the influence of alcohol. Again, it sounds good, but it is not practical at this point. There just is not that roadside test available.
Most drug testing nowadays can only tell you if someone has used drugs within a certain period of time, but not whether you're currently high. Law enforcement utilize specially trained officers known as drug recognition officers who can recognize the medical signs of impairment and determine if somebody's high while driving. But calling in one of those special officers takes time, and the training is an intensive, week-long process many small police departments can't afford to send their officers away to, according to Grant. There are a few types of breathalyzers in the works that would detect current marijuana use, using technology to detect THC levels in the breath that only remain while someone is stoned. But rollout is slow, and the technology has yet to be proven effective in the field. Grant adds if more money was put towards training these recognition officers, it would ease the strain on law enforcement to prevent people from getting behind the wheel while stoned. The 2017 Cannabis Task Force recommended these funding boosts, but the current bill does not provide direct funding for this purpose. Some groups resistant to marijuana legalization are steadfast in their opposition. Horvath says the Police Chiefs Council wasn't invited to the table to help draft this year's legislation, but he adds it wouldn't have mattered. The council would have opposed it regardless. Others, like AAA, say changes responding to their concerns could sway them. But the immediate question at hand is whether their opposition is enough to derail Delaware joining the growing list of states legalizing recreational marijuana during this legislative session. Roman Battaglia, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Roman. Next on The Green, we delve into another issue before state lawmakers, setting limits on PFAS chemical levels in Delaware's water. Stay with us. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Marijuana legalization is not the only big issue expected to be on state lawmakers' agenda when they get back to work next week. Cleaning up water in the first state is also on their minds. A bill to create a trust fund to help increase spending on water infrastructure in Delaware passed the House earlier this month and is now in the state Senate. Governor John Carney is calling for $50 million this year to get that fund started. And late last month, a bill was introduced looking to set specific state limits on PFAS chemicals in drinking water. In his latest piece available at DelawarePublic.org, contributor John Hurdle takes a closer look at that bill, how it compares to what neighboring states are doing, and where it fits in with renewed national efforts to address this issue. And he joined me earlier this week to discuss what he found. So let's start with just kind of a quick overview of what PFAS chemicals are and what kind of dangers they pose to make sure people understand what we're talking about.
Well, these are chemicals that have been around since the 1940s. They're man-made chemicals, and they're probably best known for having been used in the manufacture of Teflon nonstick cookware, but they were also used in a host of consumer products like flame retardant carpets and curtains, that sort of thing. And they were also, and still are to some extent, used in firefighting foam at airports and military bases, including Dover Air Force Base. And the reason that there's such concern about them at the moment is that they are linked to quite a long list of serious health conditions, including some cancers, developmental problems in young children, immune system issues, high cholesterol, ulcerative colitis, And so these are seen as being a significant threat to public health.
And in dealing with that threat, let's talk a little bit first about the status quo here in the first day. Where do things stand now with regulating PFAS levels here in Delaware?
Well, right now, Delaware follows the federal standard. The EPA sets what they call a health advisory limit for two of the most commonly found PFAS chemicals, that is PFOA and PFOS. The problem with these with the EPA standard is that A, it's only a recommendation rather than a requirement, and B, the level that it recommends, which is 70 parts per trillion for those two chemicals, is seen as by many scientists as being much too high to adequately protect public health. And one of the results of that is that some other states that have imposed their own regulations on those chemicals have done so at a much stricter level.
And that's the effort that State Representative Deborah Heffernan is doing with the bill that she is sponsoring right now, trying to set more stringent limits here in Delaware. What would Representative Heffernan's bill do in terms of those limits and changing where things are right now with Delaware?
Well, that bill will allow Delaware to set its own standards. She's not proposing specific levels at the moment, but she's looking for the Department of Health and DENREC to recommend regulatory levels for two of the most commonly found chemicals, that is PFOA and PFOS.
So how does that compare with what other nearby states like New Jersey and Pennsylvania are doing? They've kind of gotten a little bit of a head start on Delaware on this, right?
Well, New Jersey has particularly. I mean, it's shown itself as a national leader on this. What New Jersey has done is that they have regulated three of the commonly found PFAS chemicals. And by the way, there are thousands of them. Three PFAS chemicals over the last 3 years, and they have set levels which are very much stricter than the EPA's health advisory level for two of those chemicals. In Pennsylvania, the state recently announced its latest round of testing. They said they found. Various PFAS chemicals in about one third of the 114 sites that they tested around the state, but they said that none of them exceeded the EPA levels. Pennsylvania authorities officials say that they expect to recommend regulations later this year. That's the context. So we can see from that picture that Delaware is just beginning the process.
You talked earlier about EPA levels and guidelines and such. With that in mind, where does the federal government fit into this equation under the new Biden administration? Would Delaware be better served by national standards being strengthened rather than trying to create their own locally?
The Biden EPA is a lot more activist on the issue of PFAS than its predecessor under the Trump administration. The EPA's recently announced a new round of testing nationally. They're going to restart a process that may eventually lead to national regulation. And it's also significant that President Biden, in his massive new proposal for a national infrastructure package, is proposing spending $10 billion on and testing and remediation for PFAS. That's an indication of where federal policy stands on this. On the issue of whether Delaware would be better served by national standards, what Representative Heffernan says is that she believes that Delaware is in a position to more quickly set its own standards to protect public health than waiting for the federal government, which even though the Biden administration has been quite activist on this, federal regulations take years to become effective.
So despite all these various efforts you've been talking about, there are those who back stronger regulation who say all this is not necessarily enough. Why is that?
Well, because there's an increasing trend by manufacturers and users of PFAS chemicals to use these so-called replacement chemicals. And so what's happening is that some parts of the industry, as certain PFAS chemicals are increasingly subject to regulation, then the industry is developing replacements for those things for those chemicals, and the replacements are both A, unregulated, and B, untested, and some scientists say that the replacement chemicals may actually be just as toxic as the substances that they are intended to replace.
So let's head back to the Delaware bill for a moment. What are the prospects of it passing in this current session?
Well, they appear to be pretty good. The latest count is there's 24 sponsors from both parties. When I was reporting this story about a week ago, a GOP spokesman said that there was no Republican opposition to the bill, and there's clearly a concern about public health here, which may transcend any partisan considerations.
So there'll be a lot of efforts if this bill passes to kind of create the structure necessary to enforce it and really monitor these levels and do something about them. If that is the case, does the state have the capacity to do that, to test, to identify problems? As we've seen in recent years, there already are plenty of issues up and down the state.
Well, that's right. Well, it's unclear what the capacity would be to do additional testing and cleanup. But what we can say is that DENREC is already monitoring 12 sites around the state for different levels of PFAS, and one of those being Dover Air Force Base, which is one of the many military bases around the country where a certain kind of firefighting foam that contains PFAS has been used for years. And the result of that is that there are some places on the base where PFAS has been found at thousands of times above the federal level. So yes, I think if this bill passes, it's reasonable to suppose that the state's efforts will be ramped up.
And I suppose the state would be hopeful that the infrastructure bill would pass federally, and that has that money you mentioned earlier that would be funneled toward monitoring and testing, and that would probably maybe give the state a little leg up early on at least.
I think that's likely, yes.
So based on all the reporting you've done on this issue, is it fair to say that the requisite will now exists to make some real progress on addressing PFAS chemicals? Have we kind of reached that critical mass of getting something to move forward?
Well, it appears to be the case. I mean, this is a legitimate public health issue. I mean, it's recognized as such across the political spectrum. We've got an activist federal administration. We've got state authorities who are increasingly taking action on this, and New Jersey, for one, has shown that it can be done. And the other point is that in terms of public understanding, I mean, one of the probably significant step forward here was the release in 2019 of a movie called Dark Waters, which was based on it's the true story of an attorney who fought for and won thousands of dollars in compensation for a lot of people in West Virginia whose water was poisoned by PFAS that was that had been placed there by, it was part of wastewater coming from a DuPont plant. And so that that movie and the book that accompanied it, or that it was based on, so I'm sure succeeded in raising the public profile of this issue, which of course is sort of helping to feed into this increased political will to do something about this very serious problem.
Thanks to contributor John Hurdle for his time this week. His piece on efforts to regulate PFAS in Delaware and elsewhere is available at DelawarePublic.org. And The Green continues in a moment with the last of our interviews with three candidates running for a city council seat in next week's Dover municipal election. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Dover's April 20th municipal election has a single contested race, with three candidates vying for the at-large seat on city council. And on this week's edition of The Green, we turn to our last candidate interview in that race. Delaware Public Media's Report for America Corps member Roman Battaglia talks to Michael Lewis, a former journalist with the Delaware State News, who now manages public relations at Dover International Speedway.
First, could you tell me, how long have you lived here in Dover?
Sure. I first moved up here around 2002, 2003. I took a job with the Delaware State News. So I've been here off and on for the better part of the last two decades, so approximately 20 years. I was born and raised in Milford, about 20 miles down the road, and went to college at University of Delaware up in Newark. But for the past 20 or so years, been mostly based in Dover. I lived in Newcastle for about 18 months when I worked up at the News Journal, just to be closer to that office. But for the most part, the last 20 years, I've lived in Dover.
Obviously, you know, you lived here for 20 years. What's motivating you now to run for city council here in Dover?
Well, I've served on the Silver Lake Commission since 2019, and in that time, we've worked on everything from the plans for the new Dover Middle School at the old high school site to security cameras in the park. And this is just another a way for me to maybe expand my reach and another way for me to give back to the community. My top issue is getting past this COVID-19 pandemic. There's nothing that we talk about. There's no issue that comes up in the city that COVID has not touched, whether it's our children attending school to hotel occupancy to business development. There's nothing that COVID does not have an impact on. When I go door to door, I have a checkered flag pattern on my face mask, and that represents a couple of things. One, that I work for a speedway, and racing is our main revenue source, obviously. But number two is that we're about to reach the finish line for this pandemic. And I just, no matter what you think of the COVID situation and the COVID response in general, you know, it's here, and it's here until it's not. It's a threat until it's not, and we have to get as many vaccines in as many arms as possible. And nobody can force somebody to get the vaccine, but I'm just doing what I think is the best. I have personal experience with COVID. My wife was in the hospital for 3 days back in October with a very serious case of this. We were forced to socially distance in our own house for a month. So, I mean, compared to some other cases, and of course the more than 1,000 Delawareans who have died from this, we're the lucky ones. I mean, comparatively, we've been lucky, and we got hit pretty hard, harder than most people. So we just need to get COVID in the rearview mirror, and that should be the overarching goal of the city, obviously to keep its public safety employees and its city employees as safe as possible. It should be the number one goal. And like I said, every other issue in the city, there's no issue that that COVID hasn't touched. So I'm encouraged about the state's and the nation's vaccine response. Hopefully we can even speed it up faster. We have a vaccine site right out here behind the Speedway that is, as of a couple weeks ago, had already served about 30,000 people. I think it's been active every weekend. I hope we can continue with those efforts. And to me, that's the number one issue.
So it sounds to me like you've really noticed how much COVID has affected life here in Dover and just affected the city as a whole, and that's really what's motivating you to run, is to help with the repair of the city after COVID and helping the city recover from this, you know, pandemic.
Sure. And I mean, this, from what I understand from talking to city council members and people around the community, this is going to be a tight budget year because of COVID. You know, the tax revenues aren't going to be as plentiful as they have been in past years. So we're just going to have to take a hard look at where our funds are going. Last year's budget was approximately $140 million. I would anticipate it being around that this year, but I, from what I'm hearing, I don't envision a lot of expansion on that. And again, that's partly, I mean, I would say most of that is due to COVID, you know, just the unpredictable nature of what happened and less people going downtown for businesses, less people opening businesses. I mean, it's had an effect everywhere. There's nothing that it hasn't touched. And, you know, that's going to be one of the big challenges of whoever wins this race, joining council and helping manage that budget process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And obviously, hopefully, your position here on the city council will last past the time of COVID if things go well this year. Other than coronavirus and the recovery from that, what are some of the other priorities that you see yourself wanting to focus on the city council?
The next thing I tell people, when I knock on the doors, some of them ask what the platform is. And I said, after we get past COVID, our next task has to be examining the city's infrastructure. We have pipes in the city that are 80 to 100 years old, some of which run under Silver Lake Park, which I've been learning about and working with as part of the Silver Lake Commission. 80 to 100-year-old pipes. I mean, that bill is going to be coming due sooner rather than later, and I would hope that the city would be able to tackle as much as they can this issue sooner. The last thing we want is another, you know, Flint, Michigan situation with our drinking water, and not only the water pipes, but, you know, sewer pipes, our electric grid. We just need to make sure, I mean, 90% of the people just want their government to, you know, just maintain their basic functions, you know, public safety, the utilities and things of that nature. We need to make sure that what we can shore up is shored up, so we can, again, tackle these problems or see these issues coming sooner rather than later. There's no cheaper day to do these items or to repair these items than right now. A year from now, it'll be a tick more expensive than it is today. So, and it's just a matter of digging into the numbers and seeing what it would require to fix these items or to improve these items, and then going from there. Put it in front of the people and see what they think. So the infrastructure as a whole is one of my major issues. Another issue I have been backing and for is public safety in terms of expanding our security cameras. I understand there's approximately 100 cameras in the city right now. Whether they're in parks or street corners or light poles or red lights and things like that, I'm in favor of expanding that even more, doubling that number. I said the other day in an end call candidate forum, if you're not doing anything wrong, then you shouldn't mind that a camera's watching you, at least in the public setting. So I'd be totally in favor of not only the security cameras on our street corners, but more body cameras for our police department. Again, that's just a way to cover not only the citizens if they feel their rights have been violated, but the police officers in case a citizen or in case somebody makes a false accusation. If you're not doing anything wrong, the camera shouldn't be an issue. Mm-hmm. So those are two things that, excuse me, the infrastructure and public safety in terms of the increased security cameras, those are two of my other main topics that I speak to the constituents about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so infrastructure and then public safety, which is definitely a sentiment I've heard from a lot of other candidates I've interviewed, not just for this election, but in past elections, a lot of candidates have talked about improving public safety.
Sure. I mean, as far as infrastructure goes, those are the basics, you know, the potholes in the roads, you know, things like that. That's the basic function of a municipal government, making sure, for lack of a better phrase, the trains run on time. And if we can maintain that, and that's the first, that's public safety and maintaining that, those items, the public works, those are the big responsibilities of the local government. So mm-hmm. before we can look at, you know, the extra items, we need to make sure we're doing the fundamentals correctly.
Yeah. And then one thing I would ask is, you know, obviously you're running against two other candidates. How do you set yourself apart from your opponents in this race? What do you think makes you the best qualified to be on the Dover City Council?
Well, again, my service on the Silver Lake Commission, I've already through that, I've already met several of the candidates, and I knew a couple of them already before, you know, I got seriously in looking into city council races. So I have good relationships with almost every council member already. Since I've announced my run, I've had great conversations with those who I didn't know personally. So I feel confident that I can work together with all the council people. I stay around town. This is a little bit of a cheesy joke, but you know, you can't spell Dover without D and R. So you have to be able to bring people together and you know, forge relationships. It's great to have what you think is a good idea, but if it gets voted down 8-1, then it's pretty useless. You have to be able to forge a coalition and to work with other people in order to get things to get what you see done or to pass what you think are important issues. So I do think I have the ability to do that. My media background is part of my duties. At least early on for the state news, I was tasked to, you know, cover different town councils around Kent County. So I saw Dover's in action. I've seen Smyrna's, Milford's, other small communities within Kent County. From what I did observe, Dover's did run as smoothly as could be expected. I've seen, you know, council meetings in the past, you know, adjourn early for Monday night football kickoffs, and I've seen personality conflicts bog down things in other communities. So I would, Dover's, I will say that I'd never experienced anything like that. I think Dover's has run fairly smoothly since I've been observing it. I would hope that continues. And again, I feel I have already established great relationships with the council members as well as Mayor Christensen. So I think I'd be able to work together easily with all council members on anything and everything that comes across our plate.
Thanks to Dover City Council candidate Michael Lewis for his time on The Green this week. Dover's municipal election is April 20th from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. at the Elks Lodge on Salisbury Road. More information on the election can be found at the City of Dover's website. And stick around. We close out this week's show with a trip to the Biggs Museum in Art's Playlist. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. Two new exhibitions are up and running at the Biggs Museum of American Art in Dover. And in this week's Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele chats with Biggs curator Ryan Grover about these new shows.
Let's talk about the two new exhibitions. What's the name of the first one?
The first one, sort of the premier exhibition that's located on the first floor, it's called In Fresh Air, Impressionism and the Plein Air Movement.
And what does plein air mean for those who don't know?
I know, it's so fancy. Literally, the first label that you walk into when you see the exhibition describes to you what plein air means. So I apologize for being quite that fancy. But plein air basically is a French term for meaning outside. So these are artworks that were created outside and not in an artist's studio and not on your couch, but directly in front of the subject that you were intending to capture.
Sounds very fancy.
Sort of. It's almost kind of a way of getting back to basics, though. You know, when you're in the studio, you depend a lot on your imagination, or you depend on your notes, or you depend on, you know, the way you think things are. But this is a way to sort of think about a landscape or a cityscape or the way that a person looks or a set of animals or whatever the case, whatever it is that you're trying to capture. It's a way to sort of capture them at that moment in those particular climatic sort of conditions, so the way that the sun is hitting, the way that the clouds are over top, these kind of overcast kind of conditions that you might be in, the kind of heat that you might be experiencing. So you just get to sort of grab all of those qualities and really just sort of pack them into your painting, but in a short period of time.
I got you. So the works in this exhibit are drawn from works rarely seen at the bigs. The exhibition tracks the influence of plein air painting in the United States, particularly in Delaware. How so? Explain.
Well, so the exhibition is designed to sort of take you through a journey. It starts in the early 1800s, and it talks about the rise of artists' interest in plein air. You know, people have been painting outdoors forever. You know, that's nothing new, but they were using it as sort of notations. Sort of like they would take it back, you take these little note cards with certain color arrangements or certain sort of shapes and textures or whatever the case may be, whatever they were capturing. They would take those things back to the studio and then they would make what they would consider a finished artwork, something that they could give, you know, to show patrons or put in exhibitions or whatever the case may be. But then after a while in the 1800s, those studies became more and more important to artists and to collectors and to museums and to university professors, and all sorts of people really wanted to know more about plein air. And so it just sort of kicked off and became its own sort of vein of artwork on its own. Plein air studies then sort of turns into things like Impressionism and stuff that we really, really understand. Some of the earliest depictions of Delaware by noted artists of the 1800s were plein air studies. And we have some of them that we really never get to share. And it was really fun to be able to pull them out of the vault.
I can imagine. How many paintings in this particular exhibit itself?
Just short of 70.
Okay, so that's the first exhibit. Now there's a second new exhibition. What's the name of it? And give us all the details.
Well, this one is called Out of the Vault, Modern and Contemporary Art. And, you know, it was this... This was just kind of an exhibition by necessity. Typically, because the museum's on a timeline, we put a lot of these sort of plein air impressionist paintings, the ones that we do normally have out, we have them usually on the third floor. But I really stole everything out of the third floor and just left nothing but big empty patches of space. And so it gave me the opportunity to really pull out the modern and contemporary collections that we don't really have gallery space for. You know, we're just kind of a small museum, so we only get so far up that timeline. And this is, we were able to sort of really feature the things that are the fastest growing sections of our collection.
And how many paintings here?
We hung another 65 for that.
Wow.
So we've been very busy.
Very, very busy. All right. So let's talk about how busy you guys have been, because, you know, when I talk to art institutions so far in 2021, we've been going back in time, if you will, and talking a little bit about COVID. Did the Biggs Museum survive COVID okay, Ryan?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I would say that we did. You know, it's still a struggle. We're still trying to maintain sort of like, you know, we've lost revenue. We are in not a dire situation by any stretch of the imagination, but we've had to up our game on fundraising and other alternatives. But we're doing fine. You know what I mean? Like, we're keeping steady and we're doing it with a lot of community help, and we really appreciate that. In exchange for that help, we have been trying to maintain as much programming and exhibitions as we can, even if we've been closed. So I've actually opened exhibitions during COVID while we were closed and just shared them virtually, and then did lots of programs around them, and then gave lots of sort of online tours, and even did just sort of like simple little films through like what we call meditative tours through those galleries that aren't really interpreted, but they're just kind of a way for individuals to, in 10 minutes, to soak up the contents of the exhibition. You know what I mean? Like, we just kept coming at it and kept coming at it and really allowed ourselves to be very experimental, just find out what things would stick with the people that were looking. And our online visitation is through the roof, where we seem to have really provided something that people really appreciated. So we're not pleased that we're in COVID, but we're really pleased with how we've performed in COVID.
Ryan, I'm sure working for the museum, you've been in discussions over the months, over the past year, with other institutions, art institutions. Mm-hmm. What's the general consensus amongst that, you know, amongst all of the institutions in the first state?
We are really happy that a vaccination is out there. The range of reactions to COVID have been really mixed. And of course, we have to talk about, it's not just COVID that we're talking about. We're also talking about Black Lives Matter, and we're talking about the sort of social reckoning that cultural institutions are experiencing right now. And so both of these challenges are really sort of, the museums are being faced with, they are reacting to them in a sort of wide variety of ways. And so things are more successful for some artists, or excuse me, with some museums toward issues around COVID. Some are really excelling in social justice practice. And like so many institutions, we're really just trying to straddle the two and really trying to take things in stride and really stay on top of what it is that the expectations are.
All right. I don't want to talk about COVID anymore. I want to talk about these two new exhibitions again. Awesome. We're talking about In Fresh Air, Impressionism and the Plein Air Movement. That's one. The other is Out of the Vault, Modern and Contemporary Art. Both of them went on view March 5th. They'll stay on view through June the 19th. What's the takeaway from each of these exhibits for viewers?
Well, so two things. One was that we got to really sort of feature objects from our collection that people don't really recognize as coming from the Biggs Museum. Oftentimes when you're at the Biggs, like, people know us for our temporary exhibitions, but they also know us for like our antiques collection. I feel people come in and talk a lot about early America with us, and we do that really well. But we have this incredible third floor that I feel people sometimes don't get to. And this is a way to sort of really feature the third floor, really feature the 19th and especially 20th century, and to really talk about the jewels that we have within that collection. The other part of this, and this is something that I've been sort of enforcing with a lot of our exhibitions in terms during COVID, things that we've had to come up with on the fly, because this isn't the only sort of like quick exhibition that we've had to put together. I want it to appeal to individuals that aren't going to come to the museum. I want people to take this information and use it outside in safety where they wanted to play. And I want them to, you know, reconsider their landscape, reconsider their town, reconsider their house or the people that they see, and to use that as an inspiration to create their own artwork, to create sort of their own memories, basically, outdoors. So this is really sort of taking advantage of the spring, and it's really taking advantage of people's impulse to get healthy and just to have a good time.
All right. So in addition to the new exhibitions, the Biggs has also extended an exhibition. What's the name of that?
Tony Frizzell in Italy with the Tuskegee Airmen. And this is an exhibition that we did as a partner site within the Citywide Black History Month celebration. We actually opened the show in January. And unfortunately, most of the activities that took place with Citywide Black History Month celebration had to be virtual. We were even closed for a portion of that period, but we had the great visitation. People were really interested in these photographs that came from the Library of Congress collection. And so we just decided to extend it. Why not? You know, it's they're great images, and they some of them have become iconic, but they are a way to sort of really explore this topic in a really, really brilliant way.
Ryan, are the hours being limited at the Biggs Museum still because of COVID?
Yeah, right now. Partly that has to do with staff availability. We are in a sort of process of making sure that not all of our staff is on site all the time. So we try and do things in waves, and we don't want to necessarily overburden any one person on our small staff with having to be there all the time. So we have cut back to, I think it's Wednesday through Saturday, 10 to 4.
And you can make reservations online, really, too, to avoid wait times and make sure you and your family are going to be safe when you do go.
Right. We have time ticketing that we put in place, which was really, really helpful in our last exhibition with Salvador Dali. And it's also been very helpful around the weekends, especially with the Impressionist shows.
Thanks to Biggs Museum curator Ryan Grover and our Kelly Steele for joining us on this week's Arts Playlist. More on In Fresh Air, Impressionism, and the Plein Air Movement. And Out of the Vault, Modern and Contemporary Art, can be found at biggsmuseum.org. And that's a wrap on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, The Green can also be found via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Support for The Green comes in part from the Delaware Alliance for Nonprofit Advancement. Dana is an advocate for nonprofits, offering strategies to strengthen leadership skills, improve board effectiveness, and enhance nonprofit sustainability. Learn more at DelawareNonprofit.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributor John Hurdle, Delaware Public Media's Report for America Corps member Roman Battaglia, and DPM's Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Bernsing. Thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week here on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.